Hey, y'all. My name's Kitty Winrow, and I am an alcoholic. In 2 days, I'll have 4 years sober. And I have a sponsor who's half my age that has twice my sobriety, and I love her dearly. And I have a bunch of sponsees, and one of them affectionately calls them themselves the kitty litter. And they are here tonight, and I appreciate their support, and it's good to see some of my pigeon sisters out there. It's good to see a lot of warm faces, man. I need to be here tonight. I am so alcoholic. I was consumed with self all day, and God said, you're doing the right thing. You need to get there with some of your fellow members. And as soon as I walked up, I could feel you, you know. I could feel your love, and it's just good to get to a meeting and just go, oh, man, it's so good to be here. I drank a long time, you guys. I'm the older kitty. I see the younger kitty walking around. And she has more sobriety than me, too. But I'm gonna tell you guys a little bit about my my story and kind of get into the recovery pretty quickly, because I drank a really long time. I remember being the baby of the family, feeling a little odd, a little different, but kind of out of it, not really in tune with anything. So walking to school one day, and this little girl, she looked down at my shoes, and she says to me, when are you ever going to get a new pair of shoes? And at that point, I looked down at my little shoes, and I said, I don't know. What's wrong with them? And she goes, they're old, and they're ugly. And at that moment, I remember standing still in time and feeling completely different and completely alone and just full of fear that I was different. All of a sudden, I realized I was poor. I never knew that before. Came from a family completely full of love. But at that moment, it changed my life, and I would do anything to make myself feel different from that moment on. And shortly after that, got together with one of my little girlfriends. We went into Kmart. That was our big store at the time. And we took our bright green patent leather bags in to steal some shoes. What else? I got to change the way I feel. So we walk in, and we both get two pair of shoes. And that crazy girl got a little greedy, stole a third pair. I was like, ooh, I think they're coming after us. And I ran. I got out of the store, and she got caught. And that began pretty much the way I lived my life. I'd leave you when you were in trouble, and I'd betray you, and then I wouldn't speak to you anymore. And I would hate you if you ever did anything like that to me. You know, if you betrayed me, if you lied to me, if you did something to me that I was already doing to you, I had no use for you. But in reality, deep down inside, I wanted you to love me. I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to care about me. I wanted you to be my friend. And all through school, my little friends left, and I'd always feel alone. But I didn't realize or recognize I was alone. I was just different. I was weird, and I'd get in trouble. I'd put my hand through things to steal on the other side of fences because it looked better than what my side looked like. And I'd get in trouble because I stole, and I'd have to go make amends. And, you know, I wish I'd stayed with me, but it didn't. I drank the first time when I was 12. It made me feel really good. It made me feel alike, you guys, because it was drinking Southern Comfort, and that's what Janis Joplin drank. And I did it with my big brother, so it was cool. I drank another 4 times before I entered college, and I was really privileged in my family to get to go to college. I went to Florida State, and when I got there, I had arrived. And let me tell you, when Bill Wilson says you arrived, that's what it was like for me. I came from a little tiny, tiny little town. I thought that Jewish people were only in the Bible. And that's the truth. That's the truth. I met this girl in my dorm, and she says, her name is Greenberg. And I'm like, what kind of name is that? She goes, Jewish. And I'm like, oh, are you from Israel? I was so completely naive. So you take naivety, this poor little kid that nobody knows is poor, right? Now I'm in school. I'm pretty hot looking, by the way. So I'm fitting in with everybody, and the crowd that I fit in with, they drink. So I drink, and I drink, and immediately I have consequences. I wrap my car around a telephone pole. Immediately I had consequences, but it did not occur to me that it had anything to do with drinking. Because if you were full of fear like I was, and you took a drink that made you feel so magical and so wonderful, why would you ever stop? I'm going to read a letter to you. It's very short. It was written in 1978. So 30 years later, I get sober. And I journal a lot. If you see me in meetings, you'll see me writing. And I wrote this at a girl's house, and it says, "Sometimes being caught up in society gets you down. Your mornings consist simply of getting up, getting ready, and spending the rest of the day looking good. Your nights are filled with wine, dinner, more wine, cocaine, and sometimes dancing, if you're lucky, a good lay." Oop. I say lucky. I'm not sure that's what I meant. Then, of course, it's morning. Your eyes are red. Your stomach feels queasy. Your head is spinning around. You're hungry, but you reach for a hit of speed. You can't eat. Society says skinny. You reach for the Visine to get your red out. Take a warm bath to soothe those aching feet. No way. You don't have time. You're late. So, and it goes on to scheme about my whole day, about what I got to lie about, what I got to cheat about. But I thought it was interesting. My mom keeps all my stuff, and I was going through a box of paper, and that was 30 years ago. 30 years ago from when I got sober. So it took 30 years for it to sink in with me that I might have a drinking problem. But, you know, I lived life pretty fast and furious. I had this idea that I'd try anything once, and I did. And I did a lot of things against my own moral code, my own moral conduct. I came from a Christian background, and I'd go to church, and I'd see people feeling different, you know? It's like, what is going on here that I'm not getting? I don't know how many of you all have been to these big religious conventions where they'll lay hands on you and stuff, and I tried that, and I wouldn't even fall out. I go, there's something wrong with me, you know? There's just something wrong with me. As my drinking got worse and worse, they had me delivered. Went over to some people's houses, and they tried to deliver all the evil spirits out of me. They were finding some I didn't even know about, and that didn't work. But about 20 years of drinking, I did have a college education. I made it through. Man, those professors loved me. I'd write them letters, everything about, I just broke up with my boyfriend. Shoot, I was so shaky, I couldn't even take that test, you know. But I made it through. 5 years, I was on the leisure program. And when I got out of college, I went down to Miami, and my life pretty much opened up, and I got in a lot of trouble down there, and I stopped drinking for a little bit, for a very short while. I went on this detox fast, and then I started drinking, and I still think that after that detox fast, I crossed that imaginary line, because I was wide open after that. I drank every day for 20 years. Ask me how I know that. I'd met this guy, had a lot of money, pretty wide open, and he drank a lot, and I drank a lot. But I'm still working. I'm still kind of managing things. You know, I've got somebody taking care of me, and I liked that. You know, anything, if anybody would take care of me, that was better than me having to do it. And this guy was an alcoholic, and he died an alcoholic death. And it was horrible. I mean, his liver stopped working. It stopped functioning, and he turned yellow and jaundiced, and he was swollen out to here, and he was bleeding out of every orifice of his body. And, you know, I'd go to visit him in the hospital, but I really didn't even have a grasp on it. You guys, I was in such a state of delusion that I didn't realize that he was dying from the very same thing that I'm doing with him every single night, every single night. So he dies, and in my heart, I said, you know what, I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to stop drinking. This is crazy. I don't want to die like him. Not that I thought I would by any means, you know. I never thought I was going to die. So I stopped for 3 days. And at the end of the third day, I said, what's the use, man? I can't deal with these feelings. And for the next 11 years, I went into a state of self-pity, and I mourned over his death. And if you could give me one more reason to drink, man, self-pity was the answer. I, like, was saturated in it. Poor me, poor me, poor me. It was horrible. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I went from the wine, and I started drinking vodka, and, you know, I just kept going and going and going, and I would miss promotions at work because they thought I was a party girl. But then they finally did come around to promoting me, and I did really good, and they couldn't believe it, actually, neither could I. But I was still waking up every day just hung over to the max. I didn't know. I mean, like, I was just, like, in this delusion. I didn't know that hangovers were your first sign that you were detoxing. And later on in life, whenever I actually had to be hospitalized and detoxed, I got an idea that, ooh, in the morning when you're feeling so bad, your body's trying to tell you that it's not in agreement with what you're doing to it. So, in our book, it says that some of us have to be pretty badly mangled. And I'm one of those somebodies. I drank and I drank, and I met another guy after he died, and he was on the plane. He was walking in. He's looking pretty kind of cute and big, and I kind of summed him up, and I said, I think he's a man for me. And that's all it took. And so I was in this horrible relationship for like 10 years. And talk about blame. I appreciate Ben's story. I could relate to it totally. I would blame him for everything, for my immaturity, for my inability to cope, for my inability to put up with, you know, what was going on in the relationship. I had no coping skills whatsoever. But it really fueled the fire with my drinking. I'd moved around with a couple companies. I'm making more money. And he's just not doing what I want him to do. And this one New Year's, I decide, you know, well, I'm going to show him. He doesn't want to see me on, you know, holidays and stuff like that. I'm going to go across town. So I went across town to South Florida, South Tampa here. And 4 days later, I'm walking in my house, and I know I need help. And this is the first time I go to treatment. And I called my friend, and I called my sister, and I said, I think I need to see a psychiatrist or something. You know, I'm a little depressed. Never was I drunk, right? Well, they said, we'll be right there. Of course, people wanted to come help me because they knew I was alcoholic long before I knew I was alcoholic, right? They were willing. They showed up very quickly. One drove an hour and one was down the street, but they were there to help immediately. And they walked out the door in front of me to take me to a hospital. It's a Monday morning now, time for me to go back to work. And they walk out the door, but I don't. At that point, I just like totally, my couch was at the door. I just totally flipped backwards, and I'm in a mess. I arrive at St. Joseph Hospital, first of many ambulances to come to my house with a blood alcohol level of 0.625. And they said, you know, this is the first time we've ever seen a woman that drunk that actually lived through it. And I thought that was cool. I mean, like, I couldn't think of much to be excited about sitting in Charter Hospital, but that was little edge on things, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to figure out how I could let them know I'm depressed without letting my new boss, where I'm making now six figures, know that I got a little alcohol problem. But it got worse. But that was really the first introduction that I had to AA, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd go to some strange meetings, though. If anybody's out there and you're new, there's lots of meetings in Tampa. If you go to one and you don't like it, keep going. There's options out there everywhere. But I didn't know that because I was in a delusion. So I'd go to this biker AA meeting. And a lot of them lived out back. And I didn't quite get that because I was walking in with my stylish little fashion self. And they were saying things like, well, if you keep drinking, you'll lose your home. You'll lose your mate. You'll lose your dog. Everything will go away. But I did hear that. And I was thinking to myself as I'm walking out, oh, that isn't me. I have a job. I have this. I have that. I have my fine car. I have everything. What are they talking about? And there was a man outside the building, and he'd grab me, and he'd go, girl, what you need is God. And I'd be like, oh, man, I can't believe this. What does God have to do with my alcoholism? What in the world does God have to do with my alcoholism? I'm barely able to admit that I've got a problem. I'm full of guilt, shame, and remorse. And you want to put some more guilt on me and tell me I got to look at God right now? So I ran from that, but I kept drinking. And on the way home from work, I'd think, wow, should I go in this place to get a drink, or should I go to this AA place and go to a meeting on the way home? And I'd stop and I'd get the drink every single day. And this man that was now my husband, who wasn't living with me, by the way. I don't know. I thought I was the only girl in AA that actually bought their own wedding ring. I was so relieved when somebody else told me they did the same thing. I had no idea how low my self-esteem was, you know? I didn't even like him. You know what I'm saying? I had a drink to do it. So, needless to say, when you're with somebody that you like, basically hate, and you're an alcoholic, you drink more and you drink more and you drink more, and it's certainly their fault, Ben. That's absolutely right. But I would come home from work, and he'd be there on certain days, and I'd go, I gotta go to the bathroom, and I'd walk in the bathroom, and I'd come back out of the bathroom a different person, because I kept my vodka in the back of the toilet. And I mean, he picked up on that rather quickly, and he'd throw my vodka away, and oh man, I don't know if anybody's ever had that happen to him. You know, but you're dealing with a chronic alcoholic. You throw their booze away. That is not a happy moment. It is just not pleasant. But anyways, I eventually drank myself out of that relationship. And I kept having to go to these hospitals. And the great thing about it was I'd start to feel better after I was in there for 3 or 4 days. And I said, this is it. But, you know, my employer started having a little bit of problem with me having to go to the hospital so often for this booze thing. So then I had to manipulate that, you know, and I knew that the time was going to come where I was going to lose my job. And I remember sitting in my my kitchen. And I remember with glass in hand, I'm looking at it, and I say, if I take this drink, I know that I'm going to lose my job. I'm making six figures a year. I'm this poor kid from Auburndale, Florida. You know, this is all I worked for. This is what I went to school for. This is what I wanted to become. And that drink had such power over me that I had to take it. I did not have a choice, you guys. I had lost all sense of willpower, all sense of ability to say no. I've got a mental obsession going on constantly. I could come around to the meetings, and I thought that's how you got sober. I thought that's what you did. You just came, sat in a chair, and you got this sobriety by osmosis. I heard y'all talking about steps. Didn't apply to me. Did not apply to me for many, many years. I would come, I'd get sober, I'd go in a little bit of treatment, I'd get sober, I'd drink again. On top of page 38 is my favorite line. It says, if he were normal, you would expect him to cut it out. And let me tell you, I was not normal because I never cut it out. I drank until, like I said, 2008. There would be opportunities for me, you know, all along the line, and you know, I just kept drinking. And one time I got sober for like 9 months, and I thought I did pretty good, and life showed up. And I was like, wow, man, I need a drink. But those folks in AA told me that if I drink again, I'll get drunk. They didn't tell me about the first drink. They just said, if you drink again, you'll get drunk. I said, nah, I think I'm not going to get drunk. I'm going to try it because I feel really good. I feel healthy. I feel like I've been sober 9 months. So I drove by this liquor store, and it was like flashing lights, man. I don't think they're really that bright, but to me they were like... You can do it. And I remember walking in and going, let me see, I don't want anybody to see me, you know. But I knew I was doing it. That was the sad part. And I went in, I got this little bottle of vodka, $13 I paid for it. Good stuff. I was drinking good stuff at this time. And I sat down in my living room, I sat down on my couch, and I did this little experiment. And I had two cocktails. I enjoyed them. I did not get drunk. I did not pass out. And the blessing was I did not go into a blackout. And it was so successful that I tried it again. And that is where the phenomenon of craving with me kicks in. It doesn't automatically happen, but eventually it will happen. That's why I can't put one little ounce of vodka into my body. So I tornadoed my life through a bunch of more relationships. I kept coming around AA. My family would bring me sometimes, and then sometimes I would just go on my own. I'd go to meetings. I'd share drunk. That was my favorite. They would tolerate me. I mean, I'd probably get kicked out now, but I met this guy in the program, and that was my favorite thing to do, man, because I always felt like different and less than it. Oh, I loved men. I just loved them. Every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd pick out the cutest wood and we'd be the item, you know. Take me 3 hours to get ready for the meetings. I had to look just right. I mean, that's what I came here for. I thought that the men would solve my problem. All they did was add to it. I thought they'd fill my God hole. Darn. Wouldn't it be nice just to be able to rely on men, you know? And not on God. Anyway, so this guy's like Mr. AA, and he goes, well, girl, if I'm going to go out with you, he's 13 stepping me, right? If I'm going to go out with you, he goes, you're going to do your 4-step. And I was like, oh, okay. So I sat at home, and I remember crying all day, and I did my 4-step. And I had a sponsor in St. Pete, and I went over there, and I sat down, and I did my step work. And I got up to step 8, and I had no desire to drink, none whatsoever. But I didn't continue to work my steps. In fact, I flew to Ohio to Founders Day, and I got in a resentment against the sponsor that told me, like I told Blair last night, that I was a garden variety drunk. And I was like, I know I'm more special than that. And then I got up there, and that same guy, you know, that 13-stepper, he upset me, and I had a lot of money then. I just took a ticket. I bought a $1,000 ticket. I got to Akron Airport, and I got to tell you, the whole entire airport is under construction. There is not a bar open. I feel like that Eskimo in our big book that can find liquor anywhere. I didn't even want to drink. I had had a spiritual awakening from these steps. I'm telling you, they actually do work if you do them. I didn't want to drink, but the lower self within me was like, I'm going to do it just to piss this AA guy off, you know? So I finally found a gate, and there was this tiny little cooler there, and I had a couple beers. They tasted awful, and I got on the plane. I had two free drinks. I didn't even want them, and by the time I got to Tampa, I was driving through the liquor store in a cab getting a huge bottle of vodka, and that's what it does for me. One says, I got to have a second. Excuse me. The second says, I have to have a third. And by the third, the way I drink, I'm completely out of it. And I'm calling you up. I'm drinking and dialing. I'm calling your parents up. I'm calling everybody up. I mean, everybody I hate, I'm calling. It's horrible. It's horrible. And I went through a lot of nice treatment centers, and then I ran out of money, and I ran out of that thing called insurance, and I had to go over to 50th Street like so many times. And the last time I was in there, there was a girl that had been in AA with me, Debbie, and she's sitting there, and she looks so good, I don't even recognize her. And they invited me out to the speaker meeting that was the Mustard Seed that night, and I got kind of back involved, and I met another guy. Fast forward, I had that guy move right in with me. What time do I stop? 8:40. Okay. So I had him move in with me, and he had 6 months sober. I thought he was really cute when he was picking up that chip that night. And I walked out in the parking lot, and I said, oh, it looks like he needs a ride, too. Oh, man, I don't give boys no ride no more. He lived with me for 5 years, and we both tried to stay sober. He was not able to, and at the end of those 5 years, I was really, really bad off, and he was too. I was taking money from everybody that I knew, and we came up with this plan that he would go in the hospital for a week, and I would go into the hospital for a week after he went in, and we'd both stay sober. It sounded like a perfect plan. Two wrongs don't make a right, and two sicks don't make a well. So it was a 50-50 chance that either one of us would stay sober. And I got out, and he was not interested in staying sober. And I was in really bad shape physically, mentally, emotionally. All my relationships were broken. I was having trouble with everyone and everything. And I couldn't make a living. I was just doing this and that. I was consumed with the bedevilments. The world was against me, and I was exhausted from trying to run the show and trying to run the universe, and it wasn't working for me, and I couldn't figure y'all out, and I thought y'all were against me. And I was sober, and I went into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with a whole different feeling this time, because I was beat down into a state of reasonableness. And I asked this woman that I'd seen in the rooms before to please sponsor me, and she goes, oh, no, I have too many girls and this and that. And I'm like, listen, God is telling me to tell you to sponsor me. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And I knew at that moment God intervened, right? I knew it because I wouldn't say those words myself. And the lady kind of took me under her wing, and she brought me over to her house for a couple weeks. And this guy's still in my home, and he can't stay sober. And she says to me, you got to kick him out. I was like, I don't know where that fits into the program. You know, this is a nice guy. Who was a nice guy, by the way? His name's Michael, and he's a very nice man. And she made me kick him out, and he went into a halfway house. And about a week or two later, he was on his way over to my house, and he couldn't stay stopped. He could not stay stopped. And he walked out and at the end of my street in front of a truck. And the guy that was driving had one eye that was going straight and another eye going fishing. And they did not see each other. That's a true story. And he hit him, and then he hit him, and that he flew him into another Range Rover on the other side of the road, and it killed him instantly at the end of my street. There had been a lot of people that had died from alcoholism in my life by this point, and I never thought I would be one of them. But this particular situation, it was another one of those moments where things completely stood still and changed in my life. And I knew I was completely powerless. And for once, I knew I didn't have any control over anything. Because this was a good man that tried hard, that, you know, sought God all the time and could not stay sober, right? And I realized that I had no control over it. But the one thing that I did do, and I knew that I heard from God, was that you can make a difference, Kitty. You can make a difference. He might have died so that you stayed sober, but you can make a difference. And people from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up because I was already doing the deal. Hadn't worked my steps, but they showed up, and they took me to a meeting, and they got me through it, and I walked through that death with grace. And I learned so much from it, and how fleeting life is, and how maybe I don't think it's going to happen to me, but guess what? It was happening to everybody around me. This is a very, very serious illness, and I just didn't care. I was so like, la-di-da. But when this happened, I really started, I wanted to do something different. And I was going to meetings every single day, and I was physically ill. I could barely work, but I had to. I had animals to take care of. I had a home that I was losing that I needed to take care of, and I'd go to meetings, and I would go to the meetings just for energy. I would just go in and sit there and listen to y'all and feel the presence of God and just really just go there to make it to the next hour, to make it to the next hour. And I remember looking at the clock going, do I have to do this for the rest of my life? Now today, I love it. But at this time, I had to do it that way. And so I went, and this lady that was helping me that said she would sponsor me, I didn't think she could get me through the steps, not appropriately. So I went on to have somebody else work with me, and this lady said, you got to be very, very thorough. And she had me do a very, very thorough four-step. I put it down like, oh, man, I wrote pages and pages and pages of people that I was pissed off at. But the problem was, is I could not get to that column where they said, what was your fault? What was your mistake? I was like, none, not any. And the same fella from Ohio had been keeping up with me and had become a friend of mine and said, Kitty, I'm going to trick you into working these steps. So I went over to St. Pete and I worked the steps. And I said, I don't get that I'm selfish. I don't get that, you know, I try to run this show. I don't get all this stuff. Man, I was like so hard-headed. I would be like, are you not listening to me? And all day long, he goes, I can't take it anymore. And he walked out. And he goes, I just can't take this anymore. And I go, I know what I'll do. I'll wait till your roommate comes home and I'll ask him. And Terrence, who shares my same sobriety day, he comes in and I said, Terrence, I could just tell me what's wrong with me. I mean, let's just cut to the chase here. Really, seriously. Come on. We got to go through all this stuff. Remember, I didn't think the steps applied. So he leaned back in his chair and he started laughing. And he looked up and he goes, you know what, Kitty? He goes, I'm laughing at you and God's laughing at you because you simply just won't trust the process. And at that moment, I had another moment of clarity where everything stood still. And everything that I had written down on that piece of paper had changed the person that I was. And I don't know how to explain it because it's ineffable and it's spiritual and it's wonderful, but I had an at-one-ment with God. I go to a spiritual study on Sunday. It's Sermon on the Mount, and we talk about atonement, but we call it at-one-ment. Right then, right there at that moment, I was at one with God. And I knew that everything that was before, what had already happened, was in my past, and I no longer had to live there. And everything that was in my future was going to be okay. And I was right there in the present moment of God. And I continued, and I finished working all my steps, and my sponsor said to me, okay, time to work with somebody else. And you know what? I didn't question it. I'm going to tell you why. I thought a lot about this. He was already doing service work, and everybody I was hanging around with was into action like this group is. I respect you guys tremendously. I hear about you all over town, so it's so nice to be here tonight. I want to thank you again. But I didn't question that. It wasn't like my life depended upon it. I just did it because other people were doing it. And I knew that I was afraid and I didn't want to sponsor someone because I didn't want to screw anybody up. But then I heard that you can't screw up a newcomer. And I said, well, I'm already screwed up, so I may as well just do it, you know. So I got into the book and I called around. And I asked all these questions. How do you take people through the steps and blah, blah, blah. And I told God, I'm willing. I'm willing that you have all of me. And you know what? I'm willing that you give me a sponsee. Within 3 days, I had a sponsee. Within 2 days, I was speaking. And I haven't stopped sponsoring. And you want to know why I haven't stopped? It's because these women fulfill my life more than any other thing that I do. I don't know how to explain it, but I did a fourth step and I continue to do my steps, but I couldn't see all that selfishness as they were laying it out there to me that day. But how I see my selfishness is working with my girls. And the more I work with people and the more I, you know, try to help them out with their problems, the more I become more understanding. You know, and the more I see myself in them and the more love that I have for them. I mean, these women, as Kim says, should lay down her life for us. And you know what? That's what it becomes. We become a group and we do it all together. And I was telling Sharon before the meeting that I'm missing that link of meditation. I'm trying to do it, but as soon as I do it, like that lower self gets all busy and stuff. And I went to the bank today, and I got a money order for the spiritual retreat that's going on in the end of September because I got to do it. You know, this program is about action. It's about movement. It's about helping other people. It's about taking care of yourself and inventorying yourself constantly. And then it talks about in step 11 that we need prayer and meditation. And I have to learn how to pray because I don't know how to pray. All I know how to ask for is like, you know, more clothes, more shoes, more this, more that. You know, I had to learn how to pray. And all through the big book are tons of prayers. And my favorite one is, please remove this fear. Please remove this fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. I use that prayer absolutely every day. And the first thing that I know that God wants me to be is not in fear. Because if I'm in fear, I'm not trusting God. And you know what? I get there a lot. My fourth step was consumed with fear. I was afraid of everything. I kid around a lot because I had this little plaque in my office when I had an office that said, Fraidy Cat. And you know what? People thought it was cute, but I knew what it meant. I was afraid of everything, you know, because this was how my drinking went. I would drink, I would screw up, I would do things that were morally incorrect, and then I had to drink some more because I did that. And so I was going against my moral compass all the time. But today I don't have to live that way. Today I have the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, I have a monthly meeting with my sponsees. You want to know why? Because my sponsor does it with her sponsees. And we continue to pass this on, and we continue to get together, and we continue to support each other, and we grow, and we help each other so that there are people there that walk into the doors like I did. And we greet people so that they're not afraid. And this is an amazing, amazing life. And if I had the opportunity to continue living like I did, I would be in total darkness. Because in my darkest hour, I would call out to God and I would say, I just want my life back. I just want my life back. And God's given me my life back three times over. And, you know, I was worried because I have little kids. And my sponsor told me once, you know, you're going to have plenty of kids. And I didn't know what he meant. Now I do. I got to grow up. They got to grow up, too. But it's a wonderful life. But I didn't know any different. I didn't know I could live without alcohol. I really didn't. Had to go everywhere with it. I don't today. I don't even think about it unless I'm at an AA meeting. I no longer pass the billboards that say it only takes one sip and go, you're right. It's not part of my life anymore. And for somebody that was a chronic alcoholic, I had to drink every single minute of the day in order to survive. Because if I stopped drinking, I had to be medically detoxed immediately. So there's no alcohol in my life today. There's just love, joy, and happiness. And you know what? I am so glad to be here tonight. And thank you so much for letting me share.